Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Quite a few years ago, just after KMUN's fifth birthday, on April 17, 1988, the late Ed Niska, once upon a time prominent Finn Town historian and KMUN volunteer programmer for the Thursday morning Scandinavian Hour, made mention of the regressive devastation of the infamous Black Plague of the 14th century and its consequent depopulation of Scandinavia and the rest of Northern Europe for several centuries. Forests reclaimed villages and farmland, and wolves were seen at the outskirts of Paris, even, Niska said. Several generations after the plague, which lasted about 3 years, and Niska estimated killed two-thirds of Norway's human population, a hunter was claimed to have shot an arrow into the unseen bell of a church in the middle of a Norwegian forest, overgrown like a Mayan ruin, and he discovered a bear hibernating at the altar. Niska said that in one part of Norway, a house dating from the early 19th century was the oldest in the area, 600 years after the plague had desolated earlier settlement. The last major extinction of life on Earth seems to have been when a huge space rock smashed into the Yucatan Peninsula nearly 70 million years ago, and its impact rippled across the planet in huge ocean tsunamis and massive land fires, and most likely a great deal of rattling concussion. Dinosaurs were among the suddenly extinct species, and apparently most aquatic life, but tiny rodent-like mammals survived. We human mammals, all these millions of years later, seem to be hovering at the cusp of the next possible major extinction, the first to be caused by its erstwhile victims, which is being called the sixth extinction, and or the Anthropocene extinction, after we anthropodial hominoids, who are the major perpetrators of Mother Earth's distress. Perhaps the only possible way to avoid the extinction of humanity and assorted other flora and fauna is a massive die-off of about two-thirds or more of our species, back down to what seems to be considered a livable 2 to 3 billions of humans rather than the 10 billion we are on the cusp of. A partial die-down, such as a plague threatens, would be preferable to nuclear holocaust, which would most likely eradicate any possibility of a comeback by poisoning the atmosphere and certainly the land for centuries or more. Yet the probability of such a nuclear immolation could well be the climax of this latest pandemic, in contrast to World War I as the apparent precipitator of the last great pandemic exactly a century ago. Epidemics of war acting as bookends to epidemics of disease. It would seem almost freakishly ironic that the plagues are piggyback a century apart, nearly mirror images. But my God, why now? So sudden and unexpected. Does it have to be our families and friends? Does it have to be us? Yes, before it's too late to save the species from its own suicidal extermination, says the abstract consensus of preservation. No, screams the immediate now in self-preservation. Yet every day we wreak more havoc upon ourselves and our home planet. We eat up Earth like locusts and swarm over it as maggots on a corpse. We foul our nests recklessly with deadly pollutants that poison the bountiful waters, poke holes in the ozone membrane, and choke off oxygen. We infect ourselves with biocides meant to exterminate verminous pests and bacteria. The planet is weighted down with concrete and saturated with plastics that biodegrade nearly as exactly as nuclear radiation, half-lives, quanta quadruple human life. 75 years ago, two atomic bombs ended the worst human slaughter in its intensely bloody history, but also simultaneously initiated the everlasting threat of nuclear oblivion. At the same time, the age of biocides began, which were originally devised for the same purpose as nuclear power, to be used to destroy human beings, part of a triad of weapons of mass destruction: nuclear, biological, and chemical, NBC warfare. The post-World War period of the latter half of the 20th century, in which huge arsenals developed ever more lethal forms of weaponry, was also the advent of the plastification of the human world. And of course, as corollary to all this caustic ingenuity by our busy, ill-tempered species, this embryonic period of the third millennium is confronted with climate change, which, like the coronavirus pandemic, is not a future prophecy, but a real-time threat to human existence, as well as to every other surface dweller on Earth. Rather paradoxically, a crucial, high-priority international conference on climate change, scheduled to be held in Ireland, has been postponed for the duration of the coronavirus pandemic. A macabre, though unthinkable, outcome of this plague might be that overcrowded humanity infects itself with such enormous fatality that when the scourge ultimately flashes out, a more sustainable population would survive to refashion life and civilization, befitting Ursula Le Guin's vision of a holistically motivated naturalism. The measure of a civilization may be the individual's ability to speak the truth, she said, and whimsically suggested, I wish we could all live in a big house with lots of rooms and windows and doors and none of them locked. Yet the immense toll of life would appall and sadden with inconsolable heartbreak for perhaps a generation and grim forbearance for much longer. We have known about, and some have experienced firsthand, previous epidemics, but never before in the lifetimes of most living humans has an entire nation, virtually the whole world, in fact, been locked into our own homes as isolation wards so that we don't give or receive sickness and death to or from our friends, neighbors, and other usually sociable citizens. And amidst the prevalence of mass sickness and death, babies are born every hour of every day, rain, sun, or plague. Our breeding habits multiply us with nearly the same rigor as the virus is killing us. The pandemic of the last century, which killed between 50 million and 100 million people, the two world wars, famines, fires, and floods, other assorted epidemics and cataclysms have hardly stopped population growth, now nearing 10 billion human beings, nor will this pandemic. This current pandemic may well be a dip in the blip, but birth rates will continue to climb, obviously inducive to this period of domestic isolation, and they will eclipse those who are dying, which will impel development of more space to contain them, expanding infinity infinitely. Science fiction writers like Ursula Le Guin should be given credit for exploring all sorts of such themes as the human future on and off the home planet, however space opera or mega-galactically creative their speculation. They have at least explored and expressed the angst of our collectively curious morbidity. A short sci-fi story many years ago featured a person whose job was to entice impoverished and generally ill-educated families to migrate off Earth to a much glorified Shangri-La in outer space where everyone would dwell in perpetuity. His real job was to rid Earth of lower classes to make more room for expanding wealthier gentry. The subterfuge involved free one-way tickets for the vast crowds of off-planet migration. The rocket ships were all shot straight into the sun. And this from Ursula Le Guin, who was not simply a sci-fi genre writer, but a compassionately hopeful prophet for humanity's future. She died in 2018 at age 88, considered in her lifetime as Oregon's most acclaimed and important writer. We on the Oregon coast knew her quite well. She spent much time in her Cannon Beach home as one, and was one of the founders and teachers of the Summer Haystack program. She said, "You will die. You will not live forever, nor will any man nor anything. Nothing is immortal, but only to us is it given to know that we must die." And that is a great gift, the gift of selfhood, for we have only what we know we must lose, and what we are willing to lose. That selfhood, which is our torment and our treasure and our humanity, does not endure. It changes. It is gone, a wave on the sea. Would you have the sea grow still and the tides cease to save one wave, to save yourself? And she wrote that in her book, The Farthest Shore, in 1972, part of her Earth-Sea cycle. And now, Easter Sunday, in which Donald Trump wishes to pack America's churches amidst the raging plague, to perhaps wing to glory multitudes of souls to a grateful deity as his own entry fee into the pearly gates. It is also Astoria, Oregon's 209th birthday, founded April 12, 1811, the oldest city in the American West. It might be a moment to commiserate with sister city Astoria, New York, a swirl in the worst of the plague's deadliness in the USA. I wish to now read a personal account I wrote of having lived 30 years in Astoria in observance of its natality, 15 years before and 15 years after the millennium. I call it Astoria Exile. Several light years ago, in a previous millennium, I worked aboard a couple of tuna fish boats out of Astoria, one of which capsized in the infamous Columbia River Bar. All four of us aboard, fortunately saved by other boats whose skippers risked their boats and lives to rescue us. A few years later, I became an Astoria shorebird after being priced out of the former Republic of Cannon Beach 35 years ago. Astoria was not in good economic shape at the time. The forests were virtually logged off, and the Columbia River salmon drastically declined after a century of overlogging and fishing. City leaders were desperate for financial angels, boosting coal and oil docks, timber export schemes, and wall-to-wall aluminum plants, even a couple of shipwrecking outfits to replace defunct shipyards. Astoria's irony has been that its failed history as the oldest city in the American West has been its only marketable economy, which has ultimately spruced the old city up for the lucrative but very low-salaried tourist industry. In the interim, there was a large exodus of local families to elsewhere, which for a time provided low rents and was not yet the homeless problem currently inundated Astoria. Simultaneously, the tourism spiel was that Astoria was a living museum and flogged its antiquity as the Williamsburg of the West Coast. I quote from a first draft of a letter I wrote to a friend at the time in 1985. Astoria is a place without illusion and has little pretense about being a tough town on hard times. The town still has the character and some vestiges of its maritime past. I see little despair among the people who remain. Instead, there is an iron patience to see things through and a neighborly good humor grown and tempered from shared calamity. I do not mean that they are not pissed off or are unafraid. There is a tension here that strikes out against improper targets, such as men against women, whites against the few racial minorities who also live here or are ashore from ships awaiting berths in upriver cities. Yet an artistry is growing here, which is at a raw stage, concerned with the art itself and not so much with profit from it. though generally unnoticed and not particularly appreciated by the local majority, in contrast to Cannon Beach, which priced artists out of town, but continues to claim itself an art colony because of its tourist pandering galleries. This artistic flowering in Astoria is showing up in Astoria's old houses, cheap downtown hotels, abandoned riverside fish canneries, and out among the farms and small towns that surround Astoria. The community college, known locally as Harvard on the Hill, is a center for this arts renaissance. KMUN, the weenie bopper community radio station on the far left side of the FM dial, has, in its 2 years on the air, attracted all sorts of talent, and large old buildings are being turned into galleries rented and operated by artists, sculptors, and musicians instead of art dealers. It is an old cliche that bad times develop good art. Economic adversity does, for a fact, make rent affordable to artists. And that was a letter I wrote 3.5 decades ago. I remember long lines for the sparsest jobs, the great schemes for economic recovery that failed, except for the stubborn nut of tourism, which slowly and patiently drudged on, gradually attracting visitors, as often as not, many of whom were repelled by the beach town hordes and escalating prices. What primarily to be noted is that hardly any, if any at all, of the good-paying jobs returned or even sought to locate in Astoria. And even though increased tourism provided newer jobs for more people, only a very few offered more than minimum wage despite snowballing expenses, especially of food and lodging brought on by the expanding tourism. Few of the locals who staffed the restaurants, bars, and motels, as well as the touristry shops and food markets and other associated occupations, are assisted or protected by any form of unionization. The tourist-inspired gentrification that struck the Oregon coast like a tsunami a few years ago virtually disrupted coastal society with drastic consequences for local populations. The sudden onslaught overpriced housing and rentals, which resulted in a continuing plague of homelessness, which was already escalating nationally as a residue of the Great Recession, quote-unquote, of a dozen years ago. Millions of Americans all over the country have lost and continue to lose their places of residence. Ever-escalating millions of once-valued citizens are rendered into becoming homeless bums, quote-unquote, hardly more than police problems. Hyper-escalating property rates and rents, coupled with an epidemic scale of low-wage jobs as a result of the so-called cybernetic revolution, have provoked what might be considered the homeless devolution nearly everywhere in the USA. The causes are modeled and too often abjectly sinister. Blatant greed and unscrupulous home foreclosures generated by the odious financial collapse of 2008 are foremost among the problems, with the addendum that the major bailouts of tax money went to the banking fraudsters whose unalloyed greed was paid for with dispossession of countless American homeowners and rental tenants. The impetuous gentrification that swept upon the Oregon coast like a tsunami has been a boon for the real estate industry, especially in popular tourist areas such as Astoria has recently become. I was gentrified out of Astoria 5.5 years ago on New Year's Day 2015 and remain an unreconstructed economic exile. As I said on this program not long afterward, homeless war veterans are a national cliche, so I am fortunate my sister has allowed my unplanned imposition upon her household, where I remain halfway down the Oregon coast these many years later. The imperious gentrification that has swooped upon the Oregon coast has been a boon for the real estate industry, I said. Realty agents expediting sales and evictions claim they are just doing their jobs. That was also what we said in Vietnam when we, USMC grunts, dispossessed Vietnamese families from their homes and set fire to their villages. At least realtors don't shoot the people they cause to be turned out of their homes, and obviously don't burn down their houses. I also opine that long-time consequences for local families who are unable to find affordable places to live after eviction or any other form of forced dislocation might well be as abysmal as the fates of their Vietnamese homeowner counterparts. Now, imagine, if you will, Astoria's dystopian present if the greedy rape and pillage crowd had succeeded in their millennial intentions for Astoria. First of all, the city forest would be logged off, and perhaps the stump land platted for tourist motels. And the waterfront would certainly be dense with high-rise motels, which have perhaps been sidelined for a nonce by the plague. But it could very well have been much worse, which I sort of envisioned in a letter to the Daily Astorian, which was daily then, a scenario prompted by the LNG controversy half a decade ago. And this is the letter. So, envisage a future Astoria if corporate America overwhelms the lower Columbia River. Speculate about conglomerating gigantic aspirations for Columbia River commerce. Build the huge tanks for LNG export or import, whatever, on the earthquake-prone subduction zone. Then piggyback a coal export terminal and a crude oil export depot to the site, each built on the scale of the LNG tanks. Perhaps a mega Walmart also. And why not ship Hanford nuclear waste to be stored there in underground vaults alongside the combustible LNG pipelines? It was said in World War II that all of Europe's railroad tracks ran to Auschwitz. So one might visualize mile-long coal and oil trains streaming to the mouth of the Columbia River with toxic cargoes to supply insatiable capitalism. The river would necessarily be patrolled by Coast Guard missile ships and skywatched by armed drones from Camp Rialia. Every vessel on the river would, of course, be boarded and searched, all aircraft restricted from local sky paths to and from the county airport. The drones will watch everything and everybody. This could end the salmon allocation controversy, as it would most likely make the river inhospitable to any form of life, eventually including our own along its shores. There might be a few jobs created as a result of LNG, coal, and oil transit for burn specialists and respiratory therapists, and perhaps a sudden spike of morticiality in the very near future. Or we might think to escape the probable volatilities with massive overdoses of methamphetamines, another local economy. Flat earth partisans to the contrary, killer smog that goes around comes around. And this is Michael McCusker. Today, on April 9th, 1865, the first American Civil War ended at Appomattox, Virginia. The second Civil War is currently in prologue, a political harangue over responsibility for the failed prevention and counteraction of the raging, deathly coronavirus pandemic that will quite likely kill more Americans than all of its wars combined, and perhaps as many or more than the epidemic of a century ago. And once again, the battlefield of this uncivil war is littered with black casualties who have not been allowed much progress from slavery in the past 155 years. And today is also the birthday of the magnificent Paul Robeson, who was born in 1848. It has been a pleasure these last few nights to stare up through a silky night sky at a round yellow moon with his vaudeville comics wry grin and realize the preciousness of unfettered oxygen. Happy birthday, Astoria. And everybody, stay safe. And remember that protecting yourself protects everybody else.